Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey there, fellow true crime aficionados. We're the host of Bad Acts, a true crime podcast. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Aaron.
Join us every Thursday for twisted true crime tales of dark deeds and despicable people. We focus on lesser known unique stories with a new case each week. We've covered family annihilators, cannibals, revenge killings, killer kids, mysterious murders, survivor stories, and much more. We've even tackled stories of people who blamed zombies, vampires, ghosts, and voodoo for their bad acts.
Of course, we know they're the only ones to blame. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts, or you can visit our website at badactspod.com.
If you like fresh stories and new perspectives on crime, Bad Acts will be your new jam. Join Bad Acts every Thursday. Stay safe, y'all.
See you soon.
Hello, like mother, like murder listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
Welcome back, everyone. We're so excited that you came to join us today. We're always excited, but we're really excited because this is our 100th episode. And we are so stoked that you came to hang out with us for number 100 and that we even have 100. It's amazing.
Yeah.
100's a lot.
Thanks for joining us on this ride, everybody.
Absolutely. So we're doing, we've kind of been talking about it in some of our other episodes about this being a different one because it's number 100. And so we are going to be doing the brutal and bizarre together of
the Unabomber.
Exactly.
Yes. Cause he's got some weird things that happened to him in his life that would indicate the future.
Some the best way brutal, I can think of putting it. Some bizarre.
Yeah.
So we've done this mostly a couple brutal, of though. Other stories in the past, and we got good feedback, and we really liked doing it as a collaboration.
Yeah, go check out our Manson and our JFK ones.
Right.
I think those were the other two that we did that style.
Yes. There's not that many, I feel like, that we could do a joint one on. So it's kind of fun when we find them and we can mix them in together. Yeah. So if any of you out there are listening and you know of one story that's big and has both brutal and bizarre that we can both do together, please let us know. You can find all our contact information in the show notes. You can find us on Instagram, Patreon, email, you name it. The links are in the show notes if you want to reach us. So to go with our drink, we stepped out a little bit because it's number 100 and it's a big number. Instead of bringing a drink for the story, we decided to bring a drink for the podcast because it has been requested that we come up with a signature cocktail for the show. And so we're going to give you a Brutal and Bizarre and Boozy signature cocktail. And it's the things that we like. So hopefully you guys will like them too.
Yeah.
Okay. So this cocktail is 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce of raspberry liqueur, 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup, 2 to 3 fresh blackberries, a splash of soda water, and of course you need ice. So the instructions are to place the blackberries in a cocktail shaker, muddle them, add the bourbon, the raspberry liqueur, lemon juice, simple syrup to the shaker, shake vigorously, and then strain into a chilled and ice-filled glass, and then enjoy. So
that sounds really good.
It does. Are you ready to try it? I'm ready to try our signature cocktail. I feel like we need to come up with a really good name for it.
The Brutalizer.
Okay, well, I hope it doesn't brutalize me.
Yeah, that's all I got.
Oh, that is really good.
I like it's, that.
It's strong with that raspberry liqueur, cuts the bourbon, but it's still really
I think
fruity.
I might leave out the simple syrup next time.
Yeah, too sweet
that's
for you.
It's pretty tasty though. I feel like bourbon's already fairly sweet.
Well, and raspberry liqueur.
Yeah.
Seeing for me, that soda water, I just did a splash, but I feel like it needs a little bit more sweetness for me. But again, I'm the sweet drink person, so.
True.
Apparently I'm not sweet enough and I need more sweetness. It's just because I'm dead inside. That's fine. I need more sugar because I'm dead inside.
It's better than being dead outside, I guess.
True. True. Okay. Are you ready, Declan?
I am ready. Are you ready?
Okay. I am ready. So the Unabomber, his actual name was Theodore Kaczynski, often referred to as Ted, was born in Chicago, Illinois on May 22, 1942. He was the oldest child with a younger brother named David. And David will come in to the story later.
Yes. So when Ted was only 9 months old, he developed a rash that was pretty serious. Once his parents noticed, they immediately rushed him to the hospital. But when Ted was examined by the doctors, they were stumped. They thought it was possibly caused by an allergic reaction, but they had no idea what caused it. They suggested to Ted's parents that he remain in their care until the rash healed. Ted was in the hospital for a little over a week, and while he was there, his parents only saw him twice for about an hour each, due to the hospital's visitation policy.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I did a little bit of research, because children, like, especially when they're infants like that, they need, like, interaction with the parents to, healthily develop their mind and social abilities.
Right. And develop a relationship with their parent. And
yes. So the hospital environment presents adverse experiences for a baby, which can undermine brain development. Cumulative adverse experiences not buffered by the protection of a trusted caregiver in safe and stable environment can lead to long-term disruptions in brain development and toxic stress response.
Yeah. Not a good thing.
No, no.
But, I mean, I don't think it's been until, you know, the last couple of decades that was really considered like an attachment thing that you needed to form attachments with people, even, you know, let alone babies, but older children too, still need to form attachments. Yeah. And being, I don't know, being in a hospital sucks. If you've been in the hospital, I've been in the hospital. It's not a comfortable place. You don't want to be there. No. I can't imagine a baby being essentially locked in there. But so after his little hospital stint, he did go home. And in elementary school, his teachers described him as well-adjusted and healthy. When Ted was 10 years old, the family moved to a suburb of Chicago. His IQ was tested with a result of 167, which is considered to be highly gifted. This allowed him to skip the sixth grade, which he later said was detrimental to his school relationships.
This pushed back an already unsociable Ted. He struggled with making friends, and having skipped a grade made it even harder for him. However, Ted did end up making some friends in the chemistry lab, but this may have been a sign of what was to come. Ted and his chemistry friends would like to prank people by mixing chemicals to create small, unexpected explosions, one of which was too powerful and caused one girl in his class to temporarily lose her hearing.
Oh, shit.
So he got the ratio a little wrong and made too big of a chemical bomb at school.
Don't make bombs
it's really
at school.
Not good. No.
No. Did you have anybody do shit like that when you were in school?
No bombs at my school experience.
No. When I was in high school, one of the guys that I had gone to, like, I think it was middle school with, but he ended up at a different high school. He and some of his friends threw cherry bombs in the toilets, in the bathrooms.
Oh.
And blew them up. And he ended
that
up.
Kind
with,
of.
Yeah.
It's a nice, I've seen videos of that. It is pretty satisfying, but. Like, well, the video I've seen, it just like cracks the toilet in half perfectly, and just like, it's pretty cool.
And I would think that it would just, you'd end up cracking the toilet, but then the water attached to it is just spraying continually out.
Yeah, especially in like a school bathroom. I doubt they had like the tank. They probably had tankless, just
probably
connected to the line toilets, so it's probably just dumping. Yeah,
not good. That was the only bombs, and it didn't happen at my school. It just happened to people that I knew. They had done it. Mm. I wasn't friends with them, but it
oh,
was
they
one
did
of
it
the...
in their own house.
No, they did it at a different high school.
Oh,
they did it. It happened. Okay. So I went to Henley High School, and they did it at Mazama High School.
Oh, okay. Makes
Blue
sense.
Toilets up.
Seems like a Mazama activity.
Well, honestly, it could have happened at any of the schools. Because they were all a bunch of troublemakers. High schools are just filled with troublemakers. Anyway, back to the story. Prior to that, prior to everything, you know, skipping grades and stuff, he had some decent relationships with other students, even taking on some leadership roles with peers and socializing well with others. After skipping a grade, though, he felt other students bullied him and he wasn't able to establish many friendships. High school was a little different for Ted, though, and he became more involved with both extracurricular and academic activities. He participated in multiple groups and marching band in school. He was especially gifted and interested in math and took advanced classes. His intelligence and dedication to studies allowed him to skip the 11th grade. So you skip one grade, so then you decide to, and it makes you an outcast, so you're going to skip another grade and hope that it, I don't
you're
know.
You're already an outcast, might as well skip the other
valid
grade.
Valid point. You know, the game is lost, you might as well just, who cares at that point.
Yeah.
Taking summer classes allowed him to graduate early at the age of 15, and he was accepted to Harvard, where he began attending college at 16 years old. During his college career, he lived with other students who described him as intelligent but reserved from a social standpoint. He completed his Bachelor of Arts degree in the field of mathematics from Harvard in 1962.
Beginning in his second year at Harvard, Ted participated in a psychological experiment conducted by Harvard psychiatrist Henry Murray. On the surface, these experiments consisted of debating personal beliefs and aspirations between students. A subject was directed to write an essay about their beliefs. Those essays were then given to other students who would use the essay to make their personal verbal attacks against the author regarding the content. The author of the essay was monitored during the interrogation for psychological stress responses. Ted's participation in this group lasted for 3 years, in which he was subjected to verbal abuse and humiliation weekly.
That's not good.
The experiment was funded by the government with the goal of finding the best method for interrogation for use by the military and police. Murray wasn't just an average psychologist from Harvard, though. He had previously worked with the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA. During this time, the CIA was conducting the MKUltra program, a mind control program that utilized the administration of LSD, sometimes without the subject's knowledge or consent. And I was reading that it's believed that this was part of the MKUltra experiment, but there's not a lot of evidence to solidify that.
Okay. So it's been discussed, but...
Yeah.
I know I've definitely heard that idea come from multiple sources saying that he was part of the experiments. Not necessarily that he knew he was part of the dosing, I should say, maybe. I mean, he knew he was being, he was part of the experiment as far as like writing down the essays and then having conversations with people to defend his beliefs, which sounds like a horrible thing to do to anybody, to be like, tell me what your beliefs are and now I'm going to rip you apart and tell you you're a horrible person and you're dumb or whatever for having those beliefs. I mean,
that's pretty rough.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that. After graduating from Harvard, Ted attended the University of Michigan, where he earned master's and doctoral degrees in math.
During his time in Michigan, Ted began having horrible nightmares that consisted of him speaking with a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist would undermine and debunk everything Ted was saying about himself and using psychological torture against him until he got so mad he killed the psychiatrist. And this was a reoccurring nightmare. So he was having this frequently.
Okay. So yeah. In his dreams, nightmares, whatever, he was killing the psychiatrist because the psychiatrist was
basically doing the experiment on him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing the same thing to him that the fellow students were doing when Murray was like, yeah, yeah, just go and tell him how you think he's dumb and how everything he says is wrong. Oh my gosh.
So yeah, seems like this experiment did have a negative effect on him.
I would think so. I wonder
what
other participants in that experiment had to say about it after the fact. I wonder if they any issues too.
I'd be curious to know.
I would think so. In 1967, Ted moved to California and became an associate professor in math at the University of California, Berkeley. The following year, he was appointed assistant professor, which would have easily led him to earning tenure at the school. However, his social awkwardness followed him to his job, and the students didn't seem to like him very much. Students complained about his teaching style and lack of communication with them. For some reason, he chose to leave his job after only 2 years. His departure from the position was a surprise to his supervisors. He left California and returned to Illinois for a few years, but then moved to Montana in 1971. He lived seemingly simple life off the grid in a small cabin located outside of a small town known as Lincoln, Montana. The cabin was suitable for Ted, containing a bed, a couple of chairs, storage trunks, a gas stove, and many books. He didn't have any specific job or income and relied on financial assistance from his family. According to residents of Lincoln, this type of lifestyle was not completely unusual for the area. Ted's goal was to become self-sufficient in his cabin and on his small area of land. He didn't like people encroaching on his territory and was known for sabotaging any development efforts around his cabin. So he would like set up booby traps and things like that.
Ted's neighbors and landlords were in the logging industry and would often interrupt his peace and quiet with their loud saws and sounds of trees collapsing. One day he decided he had enough, and in the middle of the night he snuck onto their property and destroyed one of their biggest saws by throwing rocks into the blades.
But this wasn't
his only act of vandalism. One day, Ted heard a very loud motorcycle drive by. This irritated him, so his logical solution was to break into the man's house and take a shit in his bathtub. Not quite the neighbors I want. I don't want my neighbors taking shits in my bathtub.
No.
Yeah.
Oh my Super gosh. Crazy. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. He was also seen, walking around his property with a rifle on his shoulder, so he wasn't really approachable.
He was patrolling. Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
No.
He enjoyed reading and was often seen at the local library. He studied classic books in other languages, as well as sociology and political philosophy. Ted's hobbies, and I say that in quotation marks, started turning dark in the late 1970s, but this was unknown for many years. In May 1978, he made a bomb and left it in a parking lot of the University of Illinois at Chicago. The bomb was packaged in a box to look as if it were meant to be mailed, with the return address listed as a professor from another nearby college. So he filled it out. He made this package, put a return address on it, and then left it in the parking lot of a different college so that it looked like it had been mailed there and dropped. And so they gave it back to the guy whose name was on the box as a return address.
Oh, that's kind of smart, actually.
So weird to do it that way. And I think I would have just been like, I'm just going to put your name on it and leave it in the parking lot and then they'll give it to you. But
I think it's, yeah.
Very convoluted in my opinion, but maybe he had a reason for doing it that way. I don't know. The package was returned to the professor, but since the professor had never seen this package before, he was concerned and he called campus police. An officer opened the package, causing it to detonate and resulting in minor injuries. Almost a year later, Ted sent another bomb to Northwestern University. This time, the bomb was concealed inside of a cigar box that was left on a table. A graduate student opened the box and luckily only sustained minor injuries.
That's just a little tiny bomb, then, if it's in a cigar box. I always picture them being bigger.
Well, they were pipe bombs. So I think it was probably, small enough, but it had a lot of debris and shrapnel and bad things inside of it.
Okay.
About 6 months after the cigar bomb, Ted mailed a bomb from Chicago to Washington, D.C. It ended up in the cargo hold of a commercial plane and was rigged with an altitude triggering device. Thankfully, a faulty mechanism in the bomb caused it to only partially detonate. Instead of a full explosion, a couple of mailbags caught fire, resulting in smoke and an emergency landing of the plane. Experts examined the bomb afterwards and commented that if it had completely detonated, it would have destroyed the plane. As a result of the fires in the cargo hold, 12 passengers were treated for smoke inhalation and injuries. The FBI now became involved in investigating the bombings and gave the suspect a nickname referencing the university and airline bomb targets, which was shortened to Unabomb. Una for university, airline, and then bomb.
Makes sense.
Yes. Which is easier to understand when you read it, but when you say it, it doesn't make as much sense unless it's completely spelled out. So when when researching this, I was like, oh, I see it now, but I hadn't really put the two together when you just hear the name. A task force of over 125 people began at this point, led by the FBI and also included the ATF and U.S. Postal Inspectors. During the investigation, they looked at the victims, trying to determine who the suspect might be, basically trying to link, like, this guy had a bomb, that guy had a bomb, this was on an airplane, how they all connected, but they couldn't find a link between any of them. Not long after the formation of the task force, a psychological profile was made about the bomber. It stated that the suspect was likely a man with above average intelligence with connections to high level education and likely was philosophically opposed to modern technology. A few years later, the profile was changed and it was believed that the bomber was likely someone who was an airplane mechanic. Not necessarily somebody higher education wise, but they were like, oh, he's just a blue collar worker and he works on airplanes. So I don't know why they were so different, but I guess that's part of the problem with profiles is that kind of depends on who's writing it, I would think. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the bombing activities. In June 1980, Ted mailed another bomb, but this was to the president of United Airlines. His name was Percy Wood. The bomb was located inside of a book, and it detonated when the package was opened. Percy received severe injuries across most of his body and face from this bomb, but he survived, thankfully. Over a year later, in October 1981, Ted used the return address set up again. This time it was in Utah. He left a package in a hallway of the University of Utah. It had a return name and address of a professor from a different university less than an hour away. The package was given to campus police and was defused by a bomb squad with zero injuries. About 7 months later, in May 1982, a package containing a bomb was sent to a professor at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. His secretary opened the package, causing the bomb to detonate. She survived but received significant injuries to her hands and body. Just 2 months later, Ted left a bomb in a faculty lounge at the University of California, Berkeley, the school he previously worked for. It was opened by one of the professors who sustained wounds to his hands and face. 3 years later, in 1985, another bomb was left at UC Berkeley. This time a grad student found it and was severely injured when it detonated, causing the loss of four fingers and the vision in one of his eyes. In an interesting turn of events, the professor who had been injured in the previous bomb explosion at the campus was one of the first to respond to the second bomb and gave first aid to the graduate student. So kind of interesting how they tied together, but.
Yeah, that's weird.
About a month. It is a coincidence.
Shitty one, but.
Yeah, not a coincidence I would want to be involved in. Like, no. Yeah, I survived a bomb. Oh, I'm going to help somebody else survive the same thing. No, thank you.
At least he has experience.
Right. About 1 month later, Ted mailed a bomb to the Boeing company in Washington. This bomb was defused by the bomb squad without any injuries. In 1985, November of 1985, Ted's newest target was the University of Michigan. A mail bomb addressed to a professor was opened by his research assistant, which caused severe injuries to both the assistant and the professor. A month later, Ted left a bomb in the parking lot of a computer store in California. So he's getting around. It was discovered by the owner of the store, Hugh Scruton, but he did not survive. Up to this point, there had been no fatalities with any of the bombs. 2 months later, in February 1987, a bomb was disguised as a piece of lumber and left again in the parking lot of a computer store, but this time in Utah. The victim was injured with severe nerve damage in his arm and hundreds of pieces of shrapnel that had to be removed from his body. This incident was the first time Ted had been spotted leaving the bomb, resulting in the widely distributed sketch of a man with a mustache wearing aviator glasses and a hooded shirt. Anybody who's seen anything about the Unabomber has likely seen this artist sketch, which, based on our last episode, somebody who knows how to draw actually did this sketch. Ted took a few years off after this until June 1993, when he mailed two bombs to different people from universities across the country from each other. The first was sent to the home of the president of University of California at San Francisco. This victim also survived but suffered severe injuries with the loss of three fingers and partial hearing loss. The second bomb was sent to a professor at Yale University in Connecticut. The professor sustained severe injuries, including vision loss and the loss of use in his right hand. In the December of the following year, 1994, Ted mailed a bomb to the New Jersey home of an executive of a public relations firm. His name was Thomas Mosser, and he did not survive. Ted later wrote a letter to the New York Times explaining the bomb was sent to Mosser because he helped repair the public image of the Exxon Oil Company after one of their oil tankers spilled over 10 million gallons into the ocean off the coast of Alaska in 1989. So the Exxon Valdez disaster, Mosser had helped to kind of turn around public opinion of Exxon, and that made Ted upset, so he sent him a bomb. 4 months later, Ted mailed a bomb addressed to the retired president of a timber industry lobby group. It was opened by the current group president, Gilbert Murray, and he did not survive. Although most of the bombs had different triggering technology, many of the bombs had inscriptions in them. The initials FC were left on some of the bomb materials, which Ted later said stood for Freedom Club. But there wasn't really a club. He just wanted, it was like a red herring. He was just trying to distract people. I guess,
mess up his tracks, pretty much.
It could be he was the only person in the Freedom Club, but I don't know very many clubs who only have one person, but what do I know?
True.
The task force held many press conferences throughout the years requesting the assistance from the public and identifying the suspect. Based on the locations of the victims and the chronology, they believe the suspect was from the Chicago area, had some association to Salt Lake City, Utah, and was also connected with the San Francisco Bay Area. Around the time of the last bomb, Ted mailed letters to several news agencies detailing his goals associated with the bombing activities. He demanded his extensive 35,000-word essay be published word for word in a notable newspaper. He claimed that publishing his document would prevent him from further terrorist activity. So he's basically like, hey, if you publish my document, then I won't blow anybody up for a little while.
Yes.
He had sent this essay to the FBI, who named it the Unabomber's Manifesto. And as we've discussed before, manifestos are never a good thing. I don't want anything write ever to be considered a manifesto.
All the manifesto.
No, manifestos are bad things.
I mean, I can think of one instance where it's been described as something good.
Okay,
what manifesto is always used in like...
It's always a bad thing.
Bad context.
Yes. Somebody needs to write a good manifesto so we can change the image of the word manifesto.
I think a good manifesto is just called a diary. I don't...
Right? Or a manuscript.
I think manifesto specifically means bad context. Bad.
Could be. The attorney general and the head of the FBI recommended the manifesto be published out of concern for public safety, and they also hoped that it might lead someone to recognize the author. In September 1995, the Washington Post published the full document, which he had titled Industrial Society and Its Future. The document discussed how technological progress was causing harm to society as a whole and the degradation of human freedom. When the full document was released, the FBI received thousands of tips. The most important one came from Ted's brother and sister-in-law, who were able to make some connections. His brother David found some old letters from the 1970s that Ted had written with similar phrasing to the manifesto. So I guess if you're going to write shit down and you don't want to get caught, make it seem like
third person.
But write it in somebody else's topic of discussion, I guess. David provided the documents to the FBI, who had it analyzed by several linguistics experts who determined it was highly likely that Ted was their suspect. There were a few experts who disagreed with this determination, but in the end, it led to an arrest warrant for Ted in April 1996. He was taken into custody at his remote cabin in Montana. Inside the cabin, investigators found a live bomb ready for mailing. I mean, you got to have it ready. Numerous bomb-making components and 40,000 handwritten journal pages detailing bomb-making experience and Unabomber activities. Again, if you're a bad guy, don't keep journals of your bad guy activities if you don't want it to be used.
Keep journals, keep manifestos.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, don't write that shit down. They also going to be another one of our rules of bad guys. Keep your mouth shut. Don't write that shit down because it will get used against you. All of those things. They also found what appeared to be an original typed version of the manifesto. His legal team initially sought an insanity defense, but Ted refused to go that route. He was like, no, you're not saying I'm insane. I'm not going to do that. He had a few psychological evaluations from different providers while he was awaiting trial, with diagnoses ranging from paranoid schizophrenia to schizotypal personality disorder. They couldn't really come to a decision that he was any specific thing. They were just like, something's wrong with him. We don't know what it is. In January 1998, he was declared competent to stand trial regardless of any psychiatric diagnosis. The death penalty was going to be pursued, but Ted ended up pleading guilty in exchange for life in prison without the possibility of parole. He was in prison in Colorado with two other notable bombing convicts, Ramzi Youssef, who was responsible for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and Timothy McVeigh, who we have talked about in a previous episode regarding the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. In March 2021, he was diagnosed with rectal cancer and was transferred to a federal medical prison facility in North Carolina. He received treatment for the condition for a little over a year, but then refused treatment due to the side effects and low probability of recovery. He basically was feeling like shit from his treatment. And then he said, I don't want to go through this anymore because it's not even going to save me anyway, which I totally understand. And he ended up committing suicide in June of last year.
Interesting.
That is the Unabomber.
Yeah, not a cool guy. Don't send bombs over the mail.
No, let's just not make bombs and not send it to anybody as a general rule. Don't even put cherry bombs in toilets because that'll really get you in trouble too.
Or just don't do it in your toilet. Do it in someone else's toilet.
Yeah, like breaking into your neighbor's house and taking a poop in their bathtub. That's gross.
That's pretty nasty.
I can't imagine like walking into my house and being like, what the fuck happened here?
Yeah, I wouldn't even know what to think if someone broke in and they didn't steal anything. They just took a shit in my bathtub. I think I'd have more problems than if they just stole something.
Right. Ugh, gross. Steal my stuff, don't poop in my bathtub. Or just don't steal my stuff either. I mean, if you gotta do one or the other, but let's not do either. All right. Well, that is our story. first thing I want to say as far as a chaser is we got some great messages from some of our podcast friends, and we're going to play those now about our 100th episode. So take a listen to them, and then we will be right back with our own personal chasers for this wonderful episode.
Hey everyone, it's Natasha from Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy Podcast. I wanted to take a moment to come over and congratulate Jane and Declan for 100 amazing episodes. I personally have enjoyed all of your guys' topics and just love hearing about the drinks that you guys have and the fact that you guys have such a good chemistry. So, again, congratulations on the past 100 episodes. And raise a glass, everybody, because here is to 100 more. Insert a clink. Clink, clink, clink.
Hello, Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy listeners. This is Rachel, one of the co-hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder, and I wanted to come give a huge shout out to Jane and Declan for hitting 100 episodes. It's truly such a big deal and something to be so proud of. Everyone listening, please, you guys, go be sure to shout out, rate and review, and share all of the things Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy in honor of reaching the big 100. Congrats, guys.
I am the great and powerful mystery.
And I am Jay Clone 81.
We're from Cribs the Corn Podcast. And we want to say congrats, guys. Hitting the 100th episode.
It's a milestone.
And you're going to keep pumping them out to get to 200 very soon. Yeah. Now, congratulations, guys. No, seriously. Good job. It was fun hanging out with you. And we'll do another episode real soon together.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep chugging.
Bye.
Hey, it's David from Down the Rabbit Hole and co-host of One Nothing Podcast. I just want to give a shout out to Jane and Declan for 100 episodes on Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy. That is fantastic. You guys have had a lot of drinks, but I'm here for it. Can't wait to have you guys back on. I can't wait to be back on your show. It was fantastic. I love you guys. Mwah. Chef's kiss.
Jane and Declan, the goats, the be-all, end-all of podcasting. I cannot believe I have been bestowed the opportunity to speak on your anniversary because, holy crap, you guys are amazing. It's no secret. You are one of my favorite shows, very high up there. Might even be the favorite. Can't say that indefinitely because, you know, enemies and stuff, people come for the throat. But you guys are hands down the epitome of just what it takes to be podcasters, the delivery of your content, how thorough your research is. Just, I'm so impressed. You guys continue to amaze. I can't even imagine where you're going to be 1, 3, 5 years from now. You guys are going to be way up in the stratosphere, peering down on us like ants on the ground, us little people. But you guys, I just can't say enough good about you, and not just as podcasters, but as people. You've both been really accepting of David and I and our whole team and everybody that we work with, and we, you know, kind of brought you into this circle, and you've been open and just understanding and thoughtful and supportive, and you guys are just absolutely amazing. The episodes that we have done with you guys, both on yours and our show, have been just some of the best collaborations that we've ever done, and we've done a lot, so that says a lot. You guys truly are the epitome of just an amazing show, and I can't wait to see where it takes you and the success that you guys are going to reach. Phenomenal. New heights, I'm telling you. You guys are going to be the stars. You're going to be firing people, hiring people, firing those people, hiring more people, firing those new people. Anyway, probably not all of that, but you guys are still going to do amazing things, and I'm really, really excited to be here to watch you and to just see you continue down this path. And I want to say watch you grow, but honestly, it's by leaps and bounds every day. You guys amaze me every single episode. And thank you so much for being a day one supporter, and I've been a supporter of your guys' since I first entered podcasting. So it's a big deal that we're kind of buddies now to me. And I really appreciate all of your sacrifices and all of your hard work. And I'm sure this is much longer than the other notes that you got, but on their notes. So a little pop culture reference for Declan and the younger generation, of which I am no longer a member, Jane. I'm telling you. My knees, they don't work the way they used to. I'm rambling now, but I just really love you guys. Thank you so much again for giving me an opportunity to gush and express my appreciation for you both. Can't wait to see what the future brings us in working together again in the future. And I will see you for your next episode and every episode thereafter, because I'm a stalker. I love you guys. Bye.
So I'm a stupid bitch and recorded my whole note for Brutal Bazaar and Boozy's 100th episode celebration and did not include my name or my podcast or any information that would help anyone listening to determine who the unhinged lunatic was that left that note. So here I am to tell you, it is Amanda with One Nothing Podcast. You'll hear David at some point in here as well, my co-host, and my other co-host Rachel, who could not make a note at this time. Because she is mute. She's not, but we can pretend. anyway, thank you so much, guys, for including me again. I don't have my microphone with me because I was scrambling to get this done because my life is a train wreck and I'm overwhelmed and I keep forgetting things and things are falling through the cracks. So this is me having a mental breakdown saying, happy 100 episodes, Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy. You guys fucking kill it. That was me karate punching the air.
Declan, do you have a chaser?
Mom, what is your chaser?
Oh, my chaser. Okay.
Yeah, you go first.
My chaser. Still looking for mine. Okay. My chaser is a show that we've been binging on Netflix called Your Honor. And it has, I can't think of his name now, the actor who was in Breaking Bad and Malcolm in the Middle. I'm going to feel dumb that I don't remember his name, but he is a judge
Ryan
in
Cranston.
New Orleans.
There we go.
Thank you. I knew it this morning. but it's a really interesting story about like organized crime, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody. Some bad things happen and some people die, and then more bad things happen to try and cover up those things. And it's a good show. I've been enjoying it, and I highly recommend it.
I'm gonna have to check it out. I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, it's good. It's got 2 seasons so far. So.
Oh, really? I thought it was a newer show.
I think it's listed as a Showtime show, so I don't think that It's not a Netflix specific show. So it's new, but not super new.
Not new, new.
Yeah.
My chaser is also a watch recommendation. I don't know if I've already talked about this one or not, but the movie I Care a Lot. It's got.
I think you might have, yeah.
I'll talk about it again, whatever. It's got Peter Dinklage in it, the little.
Is he in that? I don't. Okay.
Yeah, he's like the bad guy in it, if I remember right. But okay. He seems to play a bad guy in everything. But it's about like scamming old people, pretty much. It's
horrible.
It's
horrible.
It's fucked up, but it's
the
a really good
that
watch.
People do that is just reprehensible.
Yeah, and she gets what she deserves in this movie, so it's worth the watch.
Yes, it's a good movie, yeah. But it will make you so angry watching it again.
Up until the end, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fairly upsetting.
Very. Well, thanks again, everyone, for coming and hanging out with us for episode 100. Thanks again to all our podcast friends who wished us wonderful good things that you recently heard them say about us. Some good, some bad, some fun. Yeah. We appreciate everyone out there who is a fan and who is listening. And if you're new and this is your first episode, please go listen to the other ones where we do a different little bit of format. But we still have fun and we still have drinks and we still talk about brutal and gross and fun and bizarre things. And so,
yeah,
here's to 100 more.
Yes, probably more than that, but
oh god, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheers, everyone. Love you.
Bye.
Bye. Hey friends, thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.